Hey everybody, Andrew here. Wanted to take a moment before the show gets started to wish a happy Thanksgiving to all of our American listeners, and I suppose a especially belated happy Thanksgiving to our many listeners in Canada. We are huge in Canada, as Nate would say if he were here with me. Also, I suppose a happy Hanukkah to our Jewish listeners. And whether you are gearing up to do some Christmas shopping, any other holiday shopping, or any shopping that you are going to do online at all, I want to let you know that there is a free and easy way that you can support the Thinking Poker podcast at the same time. If you are buying anything from Amazon, do Nate and myself a favor. Head on over to thinkingpoker.net first. And across the top of the website, you'll see a bunch of tabs. The very last tab on the right says Support the Podcast. And from there, you can find affiliate links to not just the American Amazon site, but to Amazon.ca, Amazon.co.uk. We've got links up as well to the German, the Spanish, and the French sites, perhaps. Not so atypically for the country, the Italian site was down at the time that I attempted to create that affiliate link, but I'll try to get one up for the Italian site and any other versions of Amazon that I can find as well. But if you just follow one of those links to get over to Amazon before making any purchases that you're going to make, anything that you buy will be tagged as a referral from Thinking Poker, and that means that Nate and myself will get a small percentage of the sale. It won't cost you anything additional. It'll help us out. So please keep that in mind, whether you're doing your holiday shopping or any other shopping on Amazon. Just start off at thinkingpoker.net, go to that Support the Podcast tab, and follow the appropriate link to find your Amazon. Thanks very much. Happy holidays to you again, and enjoy the show.
Danger is stealing in as relapse comes above the den. It's hard to know if this will be the day when you give in. Give in. Give in. Give in.
Hello and welcome to episode 58 of the Thinking Poker Podcast. I'm Andrew Brokus, coming to you from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. With me in Somerville, Massachusetts is Nate Mavis, and also joining us from Budapest, Hungary is Miklos. Hello, guys.
Hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Excellent. So, you know, we're hoping to talk to Miklos today, both about, to do a regular interview with him and to talk to him about strategy as well. So we figured we would just have him on the show for its entirety. So thanks for joining us, Miklos.
No problem.
So what have you been up to lately? You just did well in a poker tournament in Hungary, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it was kind of a small, so like a multi-table sit and go, like 45 people.
Mm-hmm. And we brought you on, I guess, in no small part because, well, I mean, A, because you and I are friends. And secondarily, you did quite well in the Super Knockout WCUP event, which I found to be a pretty interesting format. So I'm hoping we'll get a chance to talk about some knockout strategy with you. But you know, before we get into that, I mean, I for one would be curious just to know more about about the state of poker in Hungary generally. It's not really a country that I know a lot about. I don't know a lot about the poker scene there, other than the things that you've told me about. I mean, what's it like to be a Hungarian poker player?
Yeah, so it's like in Hungary, it's poker was in the gray zone. Mm-hmm. for years. So when I started to play, like I don't know, 6-7 years ago. It was like there were some poker clubs that were making tournaments, but in the whole, it was in the gray area. So after a few years, officials realized that, and they made these clubs to close, and they regulated the whole poker scene in a way that it's a little better than before, but there are maximum buy-ins for the tournaments and maximum buy-ins for the cash game. Mm-hmm. So you can only buy in for like, I don't know, for like 50,000 forints, which is about 230 US dollars.
Oh, wow.
And the maximum buying for a cash game is double that, so it's 100,000 forint, which is like 450 US.
And how does that compare to like the I guess the average income in Hungary? I mean, is it conceivable to be a poker professional if you were only playing poker in Hungary? Do you think you could make enough money to live off of?
Yeah, there are. I mean, at least a few hundred people who makes a living as a poker player in Hungary. That's just a guess, so I'm not sure about it. But the average income in Hungary is, I'm not sure, but I guess it's around 150,000 forint, which is like 700 US dollars, which is probably very low if you compare it to the US incomes.
That's the average income for over what period of time?
For a month.
For a month, okay. that seems really low for a year.
Yeah. That's not for a year. So, yeah.
Okay.
If you're a poker player, then you can make more money usually than this average income if you are good enough.
Yeah, but I mean, I imagine most of the better poker players are traveling, or some combination of playing online and traveling and playing other places in Europe?
It's like a lot of Hungarians are going for Vienna, Austria, mm-hmm. because until last year they had a lot of tournaments for a lot of buy-ins. They had EPT. Actually, they had only one time, but the EPT will come next March again to Austria for Vienna. And they had WPT and some other tournaments as well. But they also made some changes in the law. I guess it's end of last year. So this year it was a little different than the years before there. So there was not much tournaments, but still much more than in Hungary. So a lot of Hungarian poker players are going there. Mm-hmm. Or even they going to Prague, Czech Republic or Slovakia. Guess in Hungary it's not well managed or not the best situation to organize poker tournaments. I mean, there's only one firm, one casino, one official casino that can organize higher buy-in tournaments, and there was like one mm-hmm. this year alone.
Is the game very popular in Hungary? I mean, are most people new to it, or is it the kind of thing that like people? I mean, did you play poker as a kid?
I was a kid in the 80s, so it's a little different. it was like I haven't been introduced to Texas Hold'em until I saw Rounders, mm-hmm. Actually, we only played the five-card version of poker like in the 80s or in the 90s.
Five-card draw or five-card
tie? Five-card draw, sorry. Yeah, so there was, I mean, probably some people played stud or other versions, but I only played the five-card draw when I was young or younger.
I'm kind of curious just to know like what it was like growing up in Hungary in the 1980s. I mean, I know that Hungary wasn't as deeply entrenched in the Soviet bloc as some of those countries were, but I mean, growing up as an American in the 1980s, we were really, or I feel like I anyway, was taught that, you know, anyone living in like the Eastern Europe were really very different people from myself. And so it's been interesting for me through poker to get to know, you know, yourself and so many other people from that part of the world who, and just, you know, to realize that, you know, people aren't really so different from each other. But I'm kind of curious to know what it was like to grow up in the 1980s in Hungary.
Oh yeah. Well, it's probably it was easier in the US So, I mean, as a kid, I mean, I was like 15 when the change came. Mm-hmm. So we had not much knowledge of what else mm-hmm. out there can be. It was kind of okay. I mean, we had some holidays. On summer, we usually went to, there's a big lake in Hungary called Balaton. And we had the holidays there for like 2 weeks every year or 1 week. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. So everything was organized. So it was my father's firm's holiday resort or some sort, something like that, that we used to spend the holiday there. Mm-hmm. It was like if you wanted to buy a car, you had to apply for it and you had to wait for 4 years.
4 years.
To get one. Years. Wow. So you had to wait like 2 years, three years, five years, so whatever. It depended on which car. If you had connections, then it could have been much less. And I guess this is what it was based, but maybe it's still based on connections in Hungary. So that's probably haven't changed. But it was like we had, I don't know, six different car makers, all based in the Soviet era. So I mean, from Soviet Union or Poland or Yugoslavia or something like that. Mm. We had not much chance to travel abroad, except these countries. So East Germany was the one where I was when I was like 9 or 10 years old. Mm. I was there twice because my grandfather worked there. I have some image in my head that about the Berlin Wall, but that's all. What I remember about that. And I haven't been to the western part of Europe until, well, I've been to, in 1988, they introduced a new passport, which allowed us to go to any country in the world. Mm-hmm. Before that, we only had a chance to go for the western part of Europe or anywhere else. Every 3 years, so it was like you only had the chance to go to West Germany, for example, every 3 years, mm-hmm. and they said how much money you can get, so you had the chance to buy like I don't know $100 or 100 German mark or whatever. So they were really not. Supplied these travels, so it was very hard to travel there.
Yeah.
After 1988, it was much easier.
And by then, I mean that was pretty close to the end of communism in Hungary, right?
Yeah. That was one of the first changes, and then we had the first election after the communism in 1990.
So I guess that you've seen the country change quite a bit since you've been alive.
Yeah. But I was a small kid. I mean, I probably if I were like 5-10 years older, then would have made me think a lot of things differently. But because when I became an adult, I was already in the new era. So
I played with a guy from the Czech Republic in the WSOP a couple of years ago, and I asked him kind of a similar question, or I think maybe just about whether he played cards in the 1980s, and he told me, you know, that's all we could do. We didn't have any freedom, so we smoked cigarettes and we played cards.
Yeah, we played cards, but not just poker, mm-hmm. but we have a Hungarian card game that I mean it's a different set of cards. Mm-hmm. It's only popular in Hungary, Austria, Czech Republic. In Hungary it's called the Hungarian card, but probably in Austria it's not called that. And we have a lot of different type of games. and we played some Brummy and Canasta as well, beside poker.
Yeah, I grew up playing Rummy, and I've heard of Canasta. I don't think I even know the rules, though. I certainly never played it.
Yeah, I haven't played that for like 20 years now, but it was very popular back then.
It seems like now there's... I know you mentioned that there might be as many as a couple hundred people who are making money as poker players in Hungary, but it seems like there's a pretty small group of you who are good enough that you're like traveling around Europe and especially traveling to the US or traveling outside of Europe to play poker. And it seems like it's a pretty tight knit group. Like you guys are all kind of friends with each other. Is that accurate?
Oh yeah. I mean, I know most of the Hungarian players who travel around Europe or even America, and most Hungarians are well connected and travel together, I guess. If they are playing the WSOP, they usually rent a house together or more houses, and so probably because there's not much Hungarians playing poker at EPTs and WSOP, it's kind of easier to connect than like there are hundreds or thousands of Americans.
Right.
Do you think the game is growing there, or do you think it's reached a sort of steady state where it's about as popular as it's going to be?
It's a good question. I guess basically it depends on money. If there's not enough new players, I mean not enough players who have money but cannot play that well, the others learned how to play at least a little better than the others. Then the Hungarian economy, as well as maybe some other European countries, it's not going really well. So there's not much money to spend. I'm not sure if it's correct way to say it, but so it seems like for me. That there's not much new money coming into poker.
I see. There aren't like basic economic reasons why the game would grow, like extra disposable income or people being introduced to it for the first time. Is there a lot of advertising from online sites in Hungary? I know I've heard stories about poker stars just occasionally flooding certain markets with advertising. Like, would the average Hungarian encounter poker advertising on a frequent basis?
The other thing is online. We now have a new law. I guess it will be from next year, so from January, that it's not about poker, it's about poker and gambling, but I guess it's about gambling, the law. So if you want to organize online gambling, which includes poker, then you have to pay a fee yearly, which is 100 million forints, which is like $450,000, which is a lot. I'm not sure that how many gambling or poker sites will pay this fee. So that means, for example, Party Poker, I've already heard that they went off the market from Hungary. So they are not accepting new players from Hungary. If you have an account, you can still play on it. So there's no problem with that, but they are not accepting new players from Hungary. And I guess that if this new law will be next year, when we have this new law, then I guess not much poker sites will pay this fee, because Hungary is not that big market. So I'm not even sure if PokerStars wants to pay that or not. I guess if any poker sites wants to play that, then it's PokerStars. But even I'm not even sure about that, because it's I'm not sure if they how big profit they can make from Hungarians. So it will be, but beside that fee and besides some percentage they want to have with this fee. Beside that, they say that every profit you make on the poker site, it will be tax free.
For the players or for the
players, yes. So they want to, from the rig, they want to have, I don't know, 15% or 20%. I mean, from the profit of the poker site or the gambling site. Mm-hmm. But beside that, the players don't have to pay anything else, which is a good thing. But I'm not sure how good it is for the poker sites.
Yeah, it makes it. I mean, because it would seem like if they were serving only Hungarian player base, they could just charge a higher rake, and it would, you know, that would enable them to pay off the sites, and you all, you know, would be able to afford the rake because you weren't paying taxes on your winnings. But since you're playing on, like, you know, you're commingled with people from other countries, they can't just raise the rake for everybody.
Yeah, so it's going to be a little different, but still, it's not like they require special Hungarian sites like in France, mm-hmm. or Spain or Italy.
How would that affect you? I mean, could you see yourself moving somewhere different if you weren't able to play online in Hungary anymore?
Yeah, I guess I would. Because, for example, Slovakia is not that far from here. It's like 50 kilometers. The closest border, the Slovakian-Hungarian border is 50 kilometers. So
that would be so bad.
That's not like enough. You have to move to Canada or Mexico.
Yeah. I mean, you have a business that you own in addition to playing poker, right?
Oh yeah, I have partly owned a business. Yeah.
What's that about?
It's a food store, organic food store, actually.
How did you get started doing that?
That's a good question. I've always been interested in these kind of things, but never had the idea to make a business like that. But I knew somebody in a wholesale company, the organic wholesale company, and I've been contacted by, I had this opportunity. I just won something kind of big for me in a poker tournament at the time, and I made an investment, and then and I'm part of the company as well. I mean, I'm working part-time or something like that.
Yeah, I was wondering how that would be affected if you had to move to Slovakia.
Well, I'm pretty sure it can be organized, the two things together, because it's not like I go in every day for a full-time job. So I'm pretty sure I can manage these two things together, even if I'm not all the time here.
Yeah, I find it kind of funny. I mean, I know that, you know, Hungary has a capitalist economy now, but I think you are much more of a capitalist than I am. In the sense, you know, you own a small business, and I remember when you were in the United States visiting with me for a few days, I probably spent more time in shopping malls with you in the you know, 3 days or whatever that we were together than I did in the whole rest of the year.
yeah, it's like when I'm in the States, I'm always visiting the stores and restaurants and
Panda, so Panda Express is the one that I remember you.
I remember you telling me about that, Andrew. This is your Panda Express friend. Okay.
Yeah, Panda Express is very, very good chain. So we don't have a Chinese food chain here. Mm. Not even in Europe, I guess.
Just one small question. Why Slovakia instead of Belgrade or Serbia? I have 45 colleagues in Serbia, and I'm sort of fond of the place.
Yeah, it's like it's Belgrade, for example. I think it's like at least 200 kilometers from here. Slovakia is much closer.
I see.
So Budapest is in the north. It's in the middle of the country, but probably much closer to the north than the south.
I see. Thanks.
and Slovakia is part of the European Union, so it's much easier, for example, to move there. Then Serbia is not part of the EU, not yet at least.
Oh, that's so right. So you can kind of just almost at will just move to another EU country, right?
Yeah. It's much easier since we joined the EU.
And you still have like family in Budapest too. You'd be able to come back and visit and that sort of thing.
Yep.
So we are about to talk with Miklos about strategy for playing bounty tournaments and especially the super knockout tournaments on PokerStars. And we're going to be talking about what makes these tournaments unique and some of the specific strategy adjustments that you'd want to make for playing in these tournaments. But of course, the most important element of success is still going to be a fundamentally sound tournament game. And to improve your fundamentally sound tournament game or build a fundamentally sound tournament game, you should check out tournamentpokeredge.com. There you'll find everything you need to know about the math that underlies tournament strategy, plus hand history reviews where you can watch how winning players bring it all together at the tables. It's everything you need to know to become a winning tournament player, available now by signing up at tournamentpokeredge.com. So, Miklos, you had a pretty deep run in the $700 Super Knockout event in the recent World Championship of Online Poker. So, first off, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And you know, for folks who don't know, a Super Knockout it's like a bounty tournament, except that the bounties are huge. I mean, it's about half of your buy-in, right? Goes to the goes to the bounty. Did you seek out this tournament to play specifically, or did you play it because it was you were just like playing as many no-limit events as you could?
Yeah, I was playing most of the no-limit tournaments, except for the very high buy-ins. I played all the super knockouts. That's usually it's a replacement for the Saturday super knockout event. Just the buying was higher the second week and even higher this 700 on the third week. So I do like to play the super knockout. It's kind of unique.
Yeah, I mean, do you feel like there are strategic adjustments that other people don't make that enables you to have more of an edge in a super knockout tournament than in a regular tournament?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you have to make adjustments. Even if you haven't reached the money yet, you can make a kind of good profit if you just knock out a few players.
Yeah, and knock out two people and you break even.
Yeah, absolutely. So I remember I played the first super knockout. So it was before that it was a regular $320 buy-in tournament, and then I think it's like a half year ago they replaced it with this super knockout Saturday nights. I mean, nights for me at least. And I remember I final tabled the first one, but I guess I finished eight, so it's not big. But I remember that if I had the chance, I always played that.
What I mean, I guess the most obvious adjustment is just that, you know, when somebody shoves and you have that person covered, you can call them a lot lighter because you're getting a pretty nice overlay to try to eliminate them. Are there other adjustments that, you know, are maybe less obvious than that you make for playing this format?
Yeah, there are probably some adjustments you have to make if you want to play this. For example, in this specific tournament, I was able to almost triple up after 20 minutes. I had a set. A guy had A guy had a top kicker, but he was kind of short. And the third guy who covered both of us had just a jack high flash draw. And I'm not sure if it was a correct play to call that, but there was already two people in it, and probably he had out. So I guess it's not bad. And I had a set of eight, I guess. So I was able to almost triple up, which meant that I had the cheap lead at my table, which made this format very profitable for me.
Right, because every player at your table who you cover means that you have a chance of winning that player's bounty.
Yeah.
And if you have fewer chips than everyone else, I guess that's... Well, I guess in some sense it's a bad situation to be in because you can't win any bounties. But on the plus side, I guess since everyone is calling you lighter, you have more opportunities to double up and more opportunities to get your money in good, because people are going to make calls that, you know, chip EV-wise would be a mistake, but, you know, dollar EV-wise it might make sense because of the bounty.
Yes.
But so it can kind
definitely
of be good for both of you.
Yeah, definitely. After this tournament, I played it one or two times in October. And I remember that in this next tournament, I was kind of short stacked almost all the way. I got into the money, but it was like I had only one bounties. So it's not much. And I remember that when I had like 5, 6, 7 big blinds, there were some times that people called me very light because of that, because they called me with, I don't know, jack high or something that in a normal tournament people are not calling. And in the same tournament, for example, I busted in the money after I raised ace king under the gun. A guy from, I don't know, cutoff hijack pre-bets me. I shove, he calls me with fives, which is and it was like a new table after one or two hands, so he probably had not much info of me, and neither did I, but probably it's in a normal tournament, it's kind of a bad play with fives, but in this tournament, it's probably a plus move, because I guess it's when you are closer to the final table, then the bounties don't mean that much. But even if you're in the money, it means that you have you get about your buying back because of the bounty. So it was the 320 buy-in, and the first pay jump was like something similar, so 300 something, I guess. If you're at the final two tables, let's say, then the bounty's worth goes down, I guess. And on the final table, it counts almost nothing. But before that, it's a very good chance to make money. I mean, I make pre-flop if we are deep enough, or even not so deep. I make calls lighter. I call free bets lighter, and even my call shoves lighter than in a regular tournament.
Yeah, this is one of the adjustments I was thinking might be a little less obvious. And I tried to think a bit about, before I played these tournaments, I don't think I'd ever played a super knockout before, or maybe once. But I tried to think some about what adjustments I should make. And then it was interesting for me because you were kind enough to provide me with your hand history from this tournament, which I went through. And I noticed that you were doing this also, which was just getting involved in pots, even pre-flop, even when you were deep. I think getting involved in pots when you had somebody covered with a somewhat wider range than you otherwise would, because I guess there's always that possibility that you end up getting all in, and that that big bounty is still floating in the background anytime you're playing a pot and you have somebody covered. So it seemed like you were seeking out opportunities to call raises from people, or, you know, sometimes even to raise when certain players were in the blinds, who you knew, you know, there might be a chance that, you know, after the flop you could end up getting all in with them and having that big overlay.
Yeah, that's true. I made the most bounties in this tournament. I guess I had like 22,
yeah,
or something like that.
I wonder. I mean, I I realize these are probably a good value tournament right now because a lot of people try to play them, you know, too much like they're just regular no limit events and don't take the structure into account as much as they should. But I wonder if everyone played this format perfectly, I wonder if it wouldn't be that interesting of a format. Like if it would just be correct for people to be getting all in so often that it would turn into sort of a crapshoot.
Wouldn't there be interesting decisions just on the other end of the range? Like somebody shoves and somebody else calls and you have a big stack and Jack 8 suited. What do you do? You know?
Right.
Yeah. You know, for what big blinds? I mean, I think there would still be sort of interesting spots. They would just be different, interesting spots than the ones we're used to.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it would just sort of be, you know, certain things that are close decisions right now would become clear, get it in spots, but then other things would become close decisions instead.
Yeah. I think I'm interested in how the general reduction in fold equity affects other plays. Like in tournaments, we often make plays that involve putting the money in for a lot of reasons, not just because that's sound poker often, but because you have a lot of fold equity in a tournament. So not just in the obvious semi-bluffing spots, but also maybe when you might have the best hand, but might not, and you might not know where you are in the next street, and the other person might improve, etc. Oftentimes in a tournament, you might just put your money in if you have enough equity, and you're not quite sure what to do because you're going to have fold equity. And you know, it under conditions of uncertainty, that's sort of one stable feature that you can count on. In super knockouts, it seems like you have less fold equity generally for very obvious reasons. Do you find yourself taking more passive lines for that reason?
Actually, in this tournament, in the W Cup, I was on the bigger side. I mean, it was like I usually made the lighter calls. But when I on the other tournament I mentioned, the regular Saturday ones, I guess you have to shove a little bit tighter than a regular tournament because you will get much lighter calls, so you have to make adjustments. I'm pretty sure if the people, I'm not even sure if anyone can call you perfectly. I mean, in a regular tournament, you can assume that most of the regulars are calling you close to perfect. I mean the good regulars for sure. I don't think that it has been already figured out what's the optimal play in this kind of tournaments, because there's not that much tournaments. So basically this is this Saturday $320 buy-in, this is the only regular high buy-in tournaments in the week.
Yeah, and people just haven't like investigated the format as much.
Yeah,
I wonder if it's even possible. I mean, I was trying to think about this and I ended up kind of thinking in circles about whether there's a way to determine the value of your stack in the same way that, like, in a regular tournament, you can just take the ignoring skill for a moment. But if you're not particularly close to the bubble, and if you were a player of average skill, you could just take the number of chips in play, and you can divide that by the size of the prize pool, and you can determine approximately what one chip is worth, and then you can figure out what your stack is worth based on that, and then you can make adjustments for scale, or you can make adjustments for how close you are to the bubble. But like in the beginning of the Sunday Million, right, when you start with 10,000 chips and you've contributed $200 to the prize pool, then each chip is going to be worth 5 cents plus whatever you think your skill makes it worth. And then we have some idea that because survival is worth something, like the last of your chips are worth something more than the extra ones of your chips. But especially when you're far away from the bubble, you can just kind of look at your EV in terms of whether you are going to win or lose chips, and roughly track the dollar EV of making a particular play. But because so much in the Super Knockouts depends on whether you cover other people at the table and your ability to win bounties, it seems like it would be really difficult to... not that this would be allowed under PokerStars rules, but if I decided I wanted to buy your stack at some point in the tournament, I think it would be difficult to put a price on it, you know, for you to say, this is what my stack is worth right now, and this is a fair price for me to pay. Do you guys have any insights into how you could determine that?
Go ahead.
So I'll start by saying some obvious things, then you can say some smarter things. That's how it often goes. Half the prize pool is a standard tournament prize pool, and you can calculate your equity in that. I mean, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's at least roughly as easy as it is in a usual tournament.
You do that the same way that I described.
Yeah. So then the other half will be bounties. So you take the other half of the prize pool, subtract the bounties that have already been passed out, and then you sort of judge your probability of winning future bounties relative to everybody else in the tournament. So at a first pass, like an absolute beginning estimation, you take the bounty prize pool that is left, then divide it by the number of players still left, adjusted for stack size, or maybe you divide it by the number of chips still left and multiply it by the number of chips that you have. So,
I see where you're going with that, but it, you know, if you're contemplating something like, you know, calling a shove, and Miklos, you were talking about how valuable it was for you to have the chip lead at so many of your tables, because then you have a chance to win everyone's bounties. You know, if you're contemplating calling a shove for half of your stack, you have to take into account the fact that, you know, if you lose, maybe now you're not going to cover anyone at the table anymore. You're going to cover very few of the people at the table anymore, and that the value of your stack wouldn't necessarily go down in a linear fashion. It seems like it could decline precipitously if you no longer have a chance to win those bounties.
Yeah. Although there's a bit of two things sort of cancel out in nice ways here, which is that the closer you are to the end of the tournament, the less the bounty matters for the expectation of a play. Yeah. And the farther you are from the end of a tournament, the more likely your table is to break. And not just the likelihood of a table breaking, but the total amount of bounties, your equity comes from the total number of bounties that are out there in some sense. And so where you are relative just to the people at your table is a little bit less important. So that may at least make estimating things a little bit easier.
And I guess it's something that you should consider that, obviously it's possible that you win all the bounties in a tournament, but not very likely. So I guess in this tournament I had 22 bounties. And when I had this first final table in this format, I finished 8th, and I had 13 or 14 bounties, I guess. So what I want to say is that there's kind of a maximum bounties you possibly can have in a tournament that should be considered as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. It wouldn't really be conceivable for you to collect every single bounty in the tournament. Can I ask you about a couple of the specific hands that you played?
Oh yeah, sure.
So one of these ones that I found was interesting, and it's an adjustment that we haven't discussed yet. But there was a hand I actually noticed you flopped quite a lot of sets of fives over the course of this tournament. That seemed like it was kind of your lucky hand. But so there was a hand where you flopped a set of fives in a 3-bet pot. And you slow played it, you know, to the point where you checked and called a bet and then called a raise on the flop. The turn went check check, and then on the river now you're holding a set of fives and the board is 10-5-7-ace-8. There's 4,500 in the pot, and I think you covered your opponent, but not by a lot. You know, he had maybe 5,500 or something in his stack, and rather than making, I guess what a lot of people consider a standard value bet on the river, you moved all in. So you bet something like 5,500 into a 4,500 pot. Is that something you would have done in a regular tournament, or was that based on the fact that, you know, if he did call your shove, it would be worth so much more than if he called, like, it would be worth a lot more than double what it would be worth if he called a bet of half that amount, because then you'd win the bounty as well?
I think he had close to a pot size bet, and it covered him by a lot. I mean, what I mean is that, so usually if you want to make a regular value bet on the river, then it's not the pot size bet, even though if you have the set. But because of the bounty, yeah, that was the reason I tried to make this move. Obviously, it's definitely for value or absolute nothing. I mean, he folded, so, but because that he raised me on the flop, and it was kind of a rainbow flop, I thought that he can have something until the river that can call my shove and not ahead of me.
Right. And like you said, I mean, there's just so much, even if he doesn't call it that often, you win so much the times that he does call a shove, as opposed to the times that he calls a smaller bet.
Yeah, but in a regular tournament, I wouldn't make this river bet for sure.
Right, yeah, because you wouldn't have that extra overlay from potentially busting him if he calls.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's another example also from very early in the tournament at the 2040 level. And this, I guess, is after you've already had your triple up, because you're beginning this hand with like 20,000 chips, and most of the rest of your table has, you know, between 5,000 and 8,000 chips. There's a couple people who have more, but a player opened in middle position to 100, and this player only started the hand with about 1,600 chips. So she's beginning the hand with about 40 big blinds. So she's opening from, from the hijack, and you called in the cutoff with queen three suited. I'm assuming this is a call that, you know, you're making because of there's the chance of stacking this player. If you happen to get a favorable flop.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's true. So that was the only reason. He was the short stack at the table, and, I had like 10 times the chips. Mm. Yeah. So I covered him way too much, and that was the only reason I called this. I'm like never calling this kind of hand in another tournament. So
yeah, I should say I was really impressed with the way that you played. It's been a while since you and I have reviewed a hand history together, so I don't know if I remember a ton about how you played in the past, but I just looking through your hand histories, there were very few things that I thought were like at all questionable, and there were a lot of plays where I was like, oh, that's really good. Like I thought you played very well in this tournament. I mean, obviously you ran pretty well also, but you have to do that to go deep in a tournament. And I thought you made a lot of good decisions.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm reminded of Nate, what you were saying about having less fold equity, which certainly is true if the person you're shoving into has you covered. But I guess the flip side of that is that when you cover somebody, you can shove pretty light withdrawals because you don't really need very much fold. Like even if they call you, as long as your draw is live, you have so much overlay from the times that your draw gets there and you win the pot and win their bounty. You have so much overlay from that you really don't need much fold equity at all to make a shove profitable.
Yeah, that's got to be right. Yeah, you should be trying to get the money in the pot somehow.
Yeah, and just kind of making huge semi bluffs, I guess. I mean, it ended up, Mikulash, that you folded this flop because the action kind of went wild behind you, but you got a 6-6-4 flop with two hearts. So, I mean, you flopped a pretty good hand with a flush draw and possibly a live queen if you were able to get it in against that short stack. And I mean, it turns out instead that you bet and then got a raise and a 3-bet and you correctly got away when somebody had trips. But it seems like a spot where... After making a preflop call like this, if the original raiser had had bet the flop, you would probably want to raise and be ready to get it in here. Again, even if you didn't think you had much fold equity, like if you've got a live queen plus a heart draw, you're already at nearly 50% equity. And then that extra overlay from the bounty is going to make it pretty clearly correct for you to get it in for less than 10% of your stack.
Yeah, that was the plan, but the action behind me changed it.
So this hand, you begin the hand with 75K, and the blinds are 400, 800. So you've got nearly 100 big blinds, 90-some big blinds. And you have pocket fives, your lucky hand throughout the tournament. And the action folds to a player who is in the hijack, and he open shoves for 22 big blinds, which, you know, we were saying that shorter stacks can't necessarily count on as much fold equity, but on the plus side, it means that they can shove wider value ranges. So you might not see players, you might see players open shoving for slightly larger amounts than you would in a regular tournament, I would think. So he open shoves 22 big blinds, and then you're in the cutoff with pocket fives, and you decide to come in over the top of him. So obviously there's the overlay from the bounties, although I wonder at this point if we're starting to get to a stage of the tournament where the bounties are a little less significant. I mean, we're talking about an 18,000 chip pot, and what was the starting stack in this tournament, 7,500 chips?
75, yeah.
Okay, so I mean, this is, if we assume that you paid $350 for 7,500 chips, and then the other 350 or 375 that you paid into the prize pool was to compete for the bounties, you know, at this point, this pot is, or the amount that you're going to have to contribute to this pot is more than double what you paid your one half of your buy-in for. So, I mean, the bounty is still going to be a consideration, but the value of those chips, I think, is going to be somewhat significant compared to the bounty. So you're getting a bit of an overlay, but not as much of an overlay as you would be getting if we were to divide these pot sizes by 10, for instance.
Yeah, but if I lose these chips, I'm still kind of a big chip leader. At least at my table.
Yeah, you still have more chips than everyone else if you lose this pot.
Yeah, and as I told you, that I just had the feeling that with bigger pairs, it's better for him to raise call. Mm-hmm. I just had the idea that he's pushing this with something like ace queen or something like that. That doesn't want to raise call or play a post flop. I'm not sure. I just had the feeling that he was in late position. Oh, I was in a late position, and
yeah, and he ends up showing up with nines, which I would think in a regular tournament he might consider good enough to raise call. And I wonder if I wonder if there were any super knockout considerations that went into his choosing to open shove a hand as strong as nines, like thinking that he might get called lighter, and also that people might shove more, you know, two overcard type hands. Like people might be more inclined to shove a hand like queen jack, and anyone who has them covered, you know, could shove a hand with queen jack for some of the same reasons we were talking about. You could make a big semi bluff post flop. I guess it's also pretty profitable for big stacks to jam over raises from smaller stacks. And so maybe he was trying to stop people from doing that with some hands that might be coin flipping with him. But yeah, I was a little surprised to see a hand as strong as nines from him. I guess your call would make a little more sense to me if you were in like the big blind, but still having three players live to act behind you. It seems like, you know, there's not a trivial chance that one of them could wake up with a pretty strong hand as well.
Yeah. From the big blind, it's almost obvious call. But yeah, from this position, not sure.
So there was another one also from the 400-800 level, where so you did end up sucking out on the nines and winning that pot. So this next hand, you've got over 100,000 chips now. You open under the gun for a min raise with king jack offsuit, and the player on your immediate left, so you make it 1600, and the player on your immediate left, who has about 21k, he makes it 4400. And then a really short stack in the small blind, he basically has like began the hand with barely one big blind, so he's like half of his stack was in there just from the blind. He throws the other half in, and you shove with 72k into this guy who three bets you from under the gun plus one. Actually, I guess you shove for his stack, which would be 21k total. He made it 4400, and you shove for 21k. It would seem in a vacuum like not the best spot to shove over a three bet. And I'm wondering if the fact that you had a chance of isolating this short stack and increasing the likelihood of winning his bounty, did that factor into your decision to shove here?
Yeah, I think it was kind of obvious that the player will be all in this hand.
Right.
So that means that I should raise. I'm not seeing any two from under the gun, but kind of wide. Mm-hmm. And king jack is not that wide, I guess. And I guess I was kind of aggressive at the moment, at this stage of the tournament. I remember when I moved to a new table, I remember I was playing 100 hands with like 43, 41. So I raised 41%, which is way higher than my usual stats. But anyway, so what I mean is that I thought that the player under the gun plus one could have realized this as well as I did, that he's the guy will be all in. And could have made a play against me in a normal tournament. I'm pretty sure I'm snap folding this hand.
Folding it the first time, or raising and folding to a three bet.
Folding to the three bet.
Right.
So I'm still stealing.
So, but in this case, you're looking at, you know, because your opening range could be wider, because you're very likely to have a chance to race against the short stack, then the guy three betting you could have a wider range, and
the
combination of, you know, maybe having some extra fold equity from getting him out, plus having the bounty from the short stack, plus, you know, worst case scenario, if you're called by this player who three bets you, you've also got the overlay from his bounty, and if he is getting a little lighter than usual, then your king jack offsuit might not be in as bad shape as it would otherwise be when you get the money in under the gun versus under the gun plus one.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure he's free betting me there with he can free bet me light because of the bounty of the short stack, and even if he's not free betting light, he still can free bet some hands that are flipping versus me, or some hands that has like I have like 40%.
Yeah, I mean, you ended up getting it in your king jack offsuit versus his ace queen offsuit, which is probably a fine spot for you.
And
that it's only like 20% of your stack, and with the overlay from the bounties, it's probably a plus EV spot. And then it turns out the short stack had ace 10 offsuit, so one of the guy's aces isn't live, and you did end up winning a pretty big pot here, plus two bounties.
Yeah, so the result was nice, for sure.
You know, it's interesting. I just went through this line of thought over here, which is that I was wondering why you didn't just shove first in for like 120 big blinds, because there's so much money in the pot. Like, and it's probably a profitable play, given that shoving for, you know, 17 big blinds is correct when there's no huge bounty. And when there is a huge bounty that's effectively in the pot already, really, that pot is bloated, and you should go after it. It seems to me that the only problem with a giant shove like that is that it's really not so bad if, like again, you don't care about the fold equity that much. If you raise and you end up having to get in a bunch of big blinds with king jack against a under the gun plus one three better, that's actually not so bad, given that you're going to have that bounty also, and there will be, I guess, a few times when you can actually get away from your hand before the flop. So, would you say that just shoving first in would be a very bad play?
there were some, just let me take a look. Yeah, so there was like, some guys had like 50 or 60 big blinds. The big blind had like almost 90 big blinds.
Yeah. There's so much dead money in the pot, you know? Like, it's correct to shove for 15. I mean, if it's correct to shove for 15 or 20 or even 25 big blinds in under normal circumstances, when there's a whole buy-in in the pot already, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a bit of a silly thought, and you could imagine taking some of the bigger stacks off the table. But even so, it seems that the problem with that thought is just that you don't mind that much having to call a shove just because you get that person's bounty too, prospectively.
Yeah,
I guess the central point is just that, you know, as the big stack, you probably can be just like open chipping in some strange spots, even if this might not be an ideal one for it, but I mean, there probably are a fair number of spots where you can just open chip like 40 big blinds as the big stack.
Yeah, I guess that's correct.
And I didn't really see people doing that too much. Although actually I played with David Baker a little bit and he was doing a few things that looked a little bit like that.
Old David or young David?
Young David.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, which, you know, he of course being a really top notch player makes me think there might be something to that. I did see him making some pretty big shoves at certain points.
Oh, thank God! I was feeling like you guys thought I was an idiot and were just being nice to me. So
there was one that I was kind of surprised that you folded, Miklos. So this was a while later in the tournament at the 1500 3000 level. So now you've got like 800,000. I guess we're jumping ahead quite a bit in the tournament now. So you've got 800,000 chips, which is still a lot more than anyone else at your table, really. And you min raised from under the gun plus one with an ace deuce suited. So you made it 6,000, and then there was a player in. So he was on the cutoff. No, he was on the button. He 3-bets to 16K. So when it's coming back to you, I think you were getting something like 2.5 to 1 on a call. And you did have him covered by a good... He had 120K to start the hand. And you had like almost 800K. So, I mean, it seems like it would potentially be a spot where you've got a suited ace. You're getting decent odds to call. And even though you probably wouldn't want to call in a regular tournament... You have this player covered, so there's that the possibility of winning his bounty if you hit. Do you remember what led you to fold in this hand?
I don't remember exactly. I mean, I looked at the hand history, so I see. So the thing is that in this kind of spots, I usually call with like hand like 7-8 suited, something like that. I guess I should have called here. Yeah, maybe I had too much respect for this player. He was one of the best players overall left.
Yeah, and that is an important tournament skill, is staying out of those players' ways. And I guess by this stage of the tournament now, where we're talking about potentially putting 120,000 chips at risk, I also imagine we're in the money by this point, so chips are worth a little bit less each. But still, the pot is the dollar value of the chips in the pot is going to be pretty significant compared to the bounties by the time we're at this stage of the tournament. So I guess they're going to be influencing your decision a little bit less.
Yeah. So I mean, I guess if I'm not under the gun plus one, yeah. So probably I just didn't want it to go in. I had no intention for flopping a top pair or something like that, and then I have no idea what to do versus a good player.
I guess it's like only flopping a flush draw really is helpful to you.
Yeah. So for example, if I have like 7-8, I'm still much more inclined to call.
Mm-hmm. I just posted one other hand on here, and I just put it up right before we started, so you guys might not have even seen it yet. But it was my bust out hand from this tournament, and this was part of what I had in mind when I asked that question about, you know, does this just end up with people getting stacks in the pot really light, and does that make maybe for less interesting poker? So this hand is taking place at the 300-600 level, and I'm beginning the hand with 35K, so just under 60 big blinds, is one of the bigger stacks at the table, although most people have about that amount. And there was a very aggressive player who opened in early position. He had been playing a lot of pots generally. He had shown down like some really light early position opens before. And in this case, he was raising against a player who I believe the big blind in the hand had, yeah, the big blind had about 25 big blinds to start the hand. So it's the sort of spot where I would think a smart super knockout player would be raising this player's blind kind of wide, just looking to get involved in pots with him, knowing that there's a decent chance of winning a bounty from him if you flop well or if you run well against him. So this player opens under the gun plus one for a min raise. He has me covered, I have him covered, but it's extremely close. Although I guess that's pretty significant, though. So I have him covered, but he has almost exactly the same stack that I do. I have like 300 more chips than he does. He opens for a min raise in early position, and it folds to me on the cutoff with pocket eights. And this isn't always a spot where I would 3-bet eights against an early position raiser, but it seemed like both because this guy had shown a willingness to raise. I think he had shown up with like 8-5 suited or something in early position before. So I knew that this guy was capable of raising really wide from early position, and also that it seemed like a good blind to go after, that I decided it would be better to 3-bet him here than to flat. So I'm curious first what you guys think about that decision. I mean, we're looking at 60 big blind effective stacks. Do you think that it would be better to call here or to 3-bet and figuring that this guy has a really wide range?
I guess I'm usually calling here, but versus this guy, I'm pretty sure I can talk myself into a raise as well, because what you say about the blind.
Although, if the blind is the reason that guy is raising, don't you also want to be in the pot with him? So
yeah, I was kind of thinking that.
Yeah, given that, I mean, eights don't play wonderfully without really good information against an early position raiser, but you're a smart guy, you can handle it, and keeping the guy implicitly driving the action in the pot is a good thing also, so I would just call. But I wouldn't fold.
Okay. Yeah, so maybe I ought to have done that. And then the player in early position 4-bet me back to almost 8K. So I 3-bet to 33-33. He opened to 1,200. I made it 33-33. He 4-bet to 78-95. And the effective stacks here are about 35K. So I guess at this point, I'm still thinking like, well, I don't know if he necessarily even needs a reason to, or that if he necessarily needs a hand to do this, like if he knows that I could be three betting him light, eights might still be a pretty decent hand here. Like I may still have some fold equity. He may be getting it in with enough hands that eights has decent equity against him, and also I cover him, so there is the bounty in play as well. And I ended up chipping it for 35K here. Does that sound excessive?
After he 4-bets you, then I'm pretty sure I would have made the same shove as you did.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, he ended up calling me with ace-queen, which is not really that bad of an outcome for me. I mean, I'm flipping, and I do have his bounty in the pot as an overlay. And I guess actually now looking on it more, I guess there's more of a case for just flatting him pre-flop, which I think would be my play in a normal tournament. But it just kind of seemed like a silly spot where I didn't feel like I at least played the hand, you know, dramatically badly, or like it's very clearly better to call than to 3-bet and then to get it in. But it just seemed like all it took was one guy getting ace queen and another guy getting eights, and even though the action starts in early position, we still get 60 big blinds in pre flop, and I don't feel like either of us play the hand terribly anyway. I mean, I think it's certainly debatable for both of us at multiple decision points, but I don't think it's like either of us just spazzed out completely and we just got 60 big blinds in on a coin flip with a player opening in early position, and I feel like that was in part a function of the bounties being in play.
I guess if so the call of him, maybe I would see it much better if he covers you.
Right.
So, I mean, he's not covering you, so he's not getting anything if he wins the pot. I mean, yeah, he wins a lot of big blinds, obviously, but...
But then again, I mean, if I cover him, that means that I can be shoving wider here. So, I mean, maybe he's looking at his ace-queen as having, like, maybe he thinks I could have ace-jack.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, seems like he was right.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, though. I certainly would rarely 3-bet in this spot if I weren't going to 5-bet. I mean, there will be some players who will make the first raise very loosely, and then once they 4-bet from early position, they really mean business, and then that's one thing. But
I don't think this was that.
Yeah, I can't imagine that, given what you said, 3-betting could even be defensible, and you have any choice but to 5-bet, especially given that you cover him by a little bit. That said, I think calling is significantly better the first time around.
Yeah, and I guess I should probably consider too that if I'm 3-betting and pricing myself in to 5-bet, I mean I should be taking that into consideration as possibly another argument not to 3-bet.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess maybe it's an argument to 3-bet. Like, if you have a hand good enough to 5-bet, maybe that's more of a reason to 3-bet it. But I guess I had the power not to turn this into a 60 big blind all in preflop pot if I wanted to. And I guess I made that decision by 3-betting in the first place.
And, you know, it is possible that the other guy wasn't going after the big blind in the first place. Like, that's really a lot of big blinds to put in the pot, because the guy in the big blind doesn't have too many chips. Like, he probably did, but, you know, there's at least some chance that he's not going after it that hard. I would be, yeah. So I would just, from a better rational perspective, you really might have been wrong about that. So.
Right.
And what do you think, Andrew, that what hands would you shove here versus this guy?
For my 5-betting range, you mean? I mean, I don't think I would have done it with 7s. So, I mean, I guess 8s is pretty close to the bottom. And maybe we're saying I shouldn't have even 3-bet those. So I guess, like, maybe 9s plus. And I don't know if I would... I'd like to think I wouldn't have 5-bet ace-jack here, especially not ace-jack offsuit, although I think there's more of a case for 3-betting ace-jack than for pocket 8s in terms of how well the hands play post-flop.
Sounds like you were really 5-betting a lot of your 3-betting range.
I mean, I don't know that I'm not going to have a lot of light 3-bets here either. I mean, I'm 5-betting a lot of the top of my 3-betting range. Like, I don't see why I couldn't be 3-betting him here with, like, 8-6 suited.
Yeah, fair.
So it's more like when I actually have, like, precisely because I think this is a pretty good spot to 3-bet in light, I'm kind of disinclined to. I'm inclined both to depolarize my 3-betting range and also to not let go of a pretty wide chunk of the top of it, because I do think it has a pretty fat bottom as well.
That's fair. I guess your light 3-betting range should be more hands like ace-4 offsuit or something like that. I mean, with a hand like 8-6 suited, maybe just calling and messing with him after the flop would be better, given that you can get the big blind along before the flop, and then you might actually make something, you know? So, I mean, maybe 8-6 suit is a bad example, but I could imagine putting some of your weaker suited connected hands into a calling range, and then putting some of your blocker hands into a 3-betting range.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of value in making people fold pre-flop. I mean, I know we're talking about me having kind of a wide 5-betting range, which suggests he's going to have kind of a wide 4-betting range. But, I mean, I also think he could be opening something like 30% of the deck in this spot. So, you know, if he's going to fold something like half or two-thirds of the time to a 3-bet, that's a pretty good incentive to 3-bet, even with some hands that are decent calling candidates.
Yeah, that's fine. So if you're going to call 8s... Or say you're a guy like me who really wants to call with the 8s here, and say I'm trying to construct a calling range. What would you recommend?
I guess I'm not loving flatting here with a lot of hands. I guess if you wanted to have one, the smaller suited connectors. Well, I don't know. Maybe, I think 3-betting the smaller suited connectors and calling with the bigger suited connectors is probably better. The smaller they are, the more value there is in just winning immediately pre-flop. And the bigger they are, the more value there's going to be in seeing a flop and also in not getting 4-bet off of them. Although if his 4-bet is this small, you might even be able to 3-bet call with like a jack 10 suited, but probably better not to do that. I guess like bigger suited connected cards and probably some suited Broadway hands as well. Like, I might not 3-bet him here with. I could see just flatting like a King Jack suited as well.
Fair.
So it seems like the ace queen call seems getting worse after you explained your 3 and 5 betting ranges.
Yeah, I didn't think his call was bad, really. I think it's maybe close, or I don't think it would be an awful fold either, but I didn't look at it and be like, oh, you fish, how did you call me with ace-queen? I was sort of like, well, I guess that's all it took to get 60 blinds in was eights versus ace-queen and a short stack, or not even that short of a stack in the big blind. That was kind of my reaction to the hand. Yeah, I was going to say, anything else that you guys feel like we should say about, well, either about super knockout strategy or if Miklos, if there's anything else in general you wanted to talk about while you were here?
I guess we talked enough about super knockout. I'm pretty sure there's more to talk about, but...
We don't want to give away all your secrets.
Yeah, we have to wait another year for the next one.
Yes.
Episode 116, Miklos. Thank you so much.
All right, well, thank you. Sure. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. Tapping on my window pane. Ocean of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law? I know you won't.